For the Medical Journal of Australia, I'm Kate Swanell. Welcome to the MJA podcast. This podcast is recorded and produced on the lands of the Djabal and Djerriwarr peoples. I would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, their elders past, present and emerging.
I've been doing work on emerging viruses for 30 plus years. In all the years I've been doing this work, I have never come across a virus that can infect as many different animal species as this one. An extraordinary thing. This is the most host generalist virus I've ever come across. It just has some ability to just jump host species with remarkable ease. It's quite extraordinary.
That was the voice of Professor Eddie Holmes, one of the world's leading experts in emerging viruses. I've been trying to land an interview with Eddie since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic, to be honest, but understandably, he's been pretty busy. So when he contacted me last week wanting to talk about an article we published in Insight Plus recently on global biosecurity and the origins of the Omicron variant, I was more than happy to sit down for a chat. I'm delighted to welcome Professor Eddie Holmes as my special guest today. Why did this fire you up so much, and what's the evidence for and against?
It fired me up so much because for the past over 2.5 years now, I've dealt with this daily basis, I mean, almost daily basis. And it's extraordinarily toxic. I've had to go off Twitter. In two tweets, it degenerates into a name calling. It's so toxic. So that's why I'm kind of fired up by it. And the bottom line is, there is absolutely no evidence whatsoever this is out of a lab. I mean, absolutely none. It's all based on a coincidence of the fact that the virus emerged in the city, Wuhan, China, that happens to have a lab that works on bat coronaviruses. That's it. There's no other evidence. Now it looks at hundreds of thousands of documents. The one thing they haven't found, the most important thing, is any evidence of that virus in that lab. If you can put it there, I'll believe it's a lab leak. But there's absolutely none. And the more they look and the more they don't find it, the conclusion you should draw from this is it ain't there. And there's a very good reason why it's not there. And that's because if you look at the kind of family tree of all these SARS-like viruses, they're called the Sarbeco viruses. They're a subgenus of coronaviruses. So coronavirus in different genera. Beta coronavirus is the one that we're most familiar with that give us disease, like we get mild common colds and the first SARS virus and MERS virus, they're all beta coronaviruses. And yeah, there's one genus called Sarbeco viruses. They include SARS-1 and SARS-2. Now, this lab in China, the viruses that they've always been interested in, so the ones that they've mainly sampled and the ones that they've cultured and isolated and cultured, the ones that actually work in the lab, they are all SARS-1 like, because right, SARS-1 caused the human epidemic. They're the ones that the bat viruses that they've found, they've worked on, are the ones that are like SARS-1 like. And if they were doing lab work, if they were manipulating viruses in some way in a lab, the ones they would naturally work on are SARS-1. And they're the majority of the viruses you find. There's no evidence they've had anything. They've no evidence they've actually had SARS-CoV-2 in that lab before the pandemic. They have viruses that are quite close, but not close enough to be. And they're not the ones they would have worked on. Yeah. So scientists, we gossip, we talk, we exchange emails. There's social media. We discuss it with colleagues. All this has been looked at by the intelligence services. And they fail to produce a single piece of evidence for anyone discussing that virus, working on that virus before the pandemic. It means absolutely nothing. That's the bottom line. Again, if you can put the virus in that lab before the pandemic, I'm more than happy to believe it's a lab escape. Absolutely. But where's the evidence? Fortunately, the problem is, it has now become so political. It's also clickbait as well, right? So it's complete clickbait. So the right wing in the US are using it as a kind of, you know, pro-Trump, anti-science kind of thing. And so, and then China themselves are also now not allowing data to come out, they're fighting back against that. And so that's why it's turned into this awful political kind of football. And I think, sadly, science has lost. I think we may never even find the cause of this now, because it's so toxic.
So basically, the Wuhan lab is where it is precisely because coronaviruses are there. not the other way around.
So the Wuhan lab, they've had a lab there for a number of years, and it's a, yeah. They've got like a BSL-4 lab, i.e. the most secure lab. That lab, I should say, is about 32K away from the centre of the city. Wuhan is a big city. It's got a lot of research institutions there. So it's this massive transport hub. And that, of course, is the worst place ever for a virus to emerge, right? Because it goes everywhere, particularly just prior to Lunar New Year. But it also has, this is a critical thing, what it also has, like many Chinese cities do, are live animal markets, right? There are these wet markets that are there. I've actually been to this one in Wuhan. I took photographs of it a few years ago. And there were wildlife in there that shouldn't have been in there.
No,
there were wildlife in there that we now know are susceptible to SARS-CoV-2 virus. I remember talking to my colleagues in China. We walked around this market and I saw these animals and I said, this isn't good. And that brings another point, which I think is very, very critical to me. This, to me, is the kind of the key thing, almost the key thing of all, right, apart from the virus not being in the lab, is that SARS-1, if you remember back in 2003, that emerged in a live animal market in Guangdong province in southern China. Right? SARS-2 is first detected in a live animal market in Wuhan, in Hubei province, in more central eastern China. They're both first detected in an animal market. What are the odds? If the virus emerged in a lab, what are the odds that it is then first detected in the very place you'd expect it to be if it was a natural origin? And I would say the odds are infinitesimally small. Why didn't it appear anywhere else in Wuhan? Why this live animal market? And I think the odds of that, you think it through, it just seems extraordinarily unlikely.
Viruses jumping from animals to humans is your thing. Where are we at with SARS-CoV-2 in terms of understanding how it's mutating and how it's evolving? What are we looking at in terms of coming nightmares?
I've been doing work on emerging viruses for 30 plus years, and I've probably published as much as anyone globally on this topic. In all the years that I've been doing this work, I have never come across a virus that can infect as many different animal species as this one. It's just incredible. I mean, it's extreme. Every day. So yesterday, a preprint was published on the virus infecting a whole bunch of animals in the USA, including American possums. They're not as cute as our Australian possums.
No, they're bitey.
They are. Yeah. So suddenly, the virus has got into American possums. It's in armadillos. It's in deer. It's in mink. It's in cats. It's absolutely incredible prevalences in deer, right? An extraordinary thing. This is the most host generalist virus I've ever come across. It just has some ability to just jump host species with remarkable ease. It's quite extraordinary. It's going to establish these animal reservoirs, right? It already has.
Yeah.
Luckily, not yet in Australia. Not here yet, but it could do, you know?
What kind of conditions need to be there for a virus to become that generous in terms of receptor?
That's a really great question. And a lot of research has kind of gone into that. And I don't really have a good answer for you. To me, the most likely things are, one, that respiratory viruses tend to be pretty good. Because you imagine they're just being breathed in and out, right? And
so
if you're in contact, you've got more chance of getting them. So that's one thing. Also, I think, again, is this cell receptor virus interaction. If those cell receptors, these little bits of sequence on the outside of little proteins outside of your cells, if they're quite conserved between different species, then a virus is going to be able to get into those different species cells quite easily. It's like having a lock and key.
Yes.
And the locks are actually quite similar on all the doors, right? The virus key can kind of get in quite easily. Then it adapts a bit. So I think that's the most likely explanation. But SARS-CoV-2 is something else. It's just incredible.
Does that mean we're stuck with it?
Oh, yeah. No doubt. Absolutely. We're stuck with this. We're stuck with this. I don't want to be people depressed, right? But we're stuck with this for probably ever. I don't think it's massively seasonal yet still. I tend to see when you get a new variant, you get kind of global sweeps of that variant. Seasonality will probably kick in. When you get high immunity in the population, seasonality is more important for the virus. Because if there's no immunity, it spreads very easily, so it kind of gets going. If there's high immunity, it will only spread in the right kind of environment, in conditions in the environment, right temperature, humidity kind of thing. I don't think we're quite there yet. But we're not going to get rid of this, right? I mean, I think we're still quite early on in the evolutionary phase of this thing. If you look at when you get a new virus emerge, the first few years, and by few, I mean maybe 4 or 5 years, you tend to see a lot of kind of like just stochastic wobble, okay? A lot of kind of chance effects going on. Because it's not fully adapted, you've got a complicated set of factors going on. Some populations are immune, some are non-immune. Different kinds of global travel. All those things give you this kind of very up and down kind of random kind of pattern. Then it starts to settle down as it gets into this kind of host virus coevolution. And I don't think we're quite there yet. I think we're probably getting there, but I think we've got a while to go.
I'm chatting today with Professor Eddie Holmes, ARC Australian Laureate Fellow and leading expert on emerging viruses from the University of Sydney, about SARS-CoV-2, conspiracy theories, and the three viruses that worry him the most. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can catch up with our back catalogue at mja.com.au/podcasts. You can also sign up for future podcasts by searching for the Medical Journal of Australia on your favourite podcast platform and hitting the subscribe button. Back to our chat with Eddie. Does that wobbling make it harder to develop a vaccine that will cope with all variants?
Not necessarily. I think it makes it harder to predict what's going to come next. I think that's the difficult thing. I think prediction's very, very, as Niels Bohr said, prediction's very difficult, especially about the future, right? I think he's, I think he's got that spot on. Again, to sort of lighten the tone, I think the vaccine development has been phenomenal, right? I mean, it's just absolutely extraordinary thing, particularly with the mRNA vaccine. Now we're in the era of bivalent vaccines, right? Which people miss, they increase protection. So I think trying to second guess exactly what's going to emerge next, I think that's quite hard to do. I mean, the virus has evolved much more than I thought it would do. It's much more infectious now than it was in Wuhan in December 2019.
Yeah.
So, but I think what you'll see is the vaccine companies will continually update their vaccines. The Holy Grail is a cross-protective vaccine, as it always is for everything, right? So you know, lots of work going into that. We're not at that stage yet. I had COVID actually just a couple of weeks ago, my first go. So I'd had 4 vaccine shots and I'm so glad I had 4 vaccine shots, quite frankly.
Yeah.
But my personal view is you need to vaccinate as broadly and as widely as
possible. Put it in the arms of whoever wants it.
Every can. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. One of the kind of side issues of this pandemic has been, great though the vaccination development has been, vaccine sharing has been abysmal.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the reasons why the virus has been able to evolve the way it did is the fact that we didn't give enough protection. We didn't share our doses with countries that needed it. Some people have suggested that the Omicron variant was a lack. It emerged in sub-Saharan Africa, where there are an enormous number of people who are immunocompromised, right? And the virus in immunocompromised hosts evolves in a very different way. It picks up lots and lots of mutations, right? And we didn't have that. Population was not well vaccinated because we were not giving our vaccines out. We were not sharing them. So you've got this massive population of people immunocompromised, partly because of HIV and lots of other things too. And the virus in these people establishes long-term persistent infections, and it picks up just a whole slew of mutations. If you look at Omicron, the reason why Omicron is not a designed mutation, it's not out of a lab, is because it's not just the spike protein that everyone talks about that's changed. The whole genome has changed because it's picked up lots of mutations because it's probably been an immunocompromised host. But again, there's no way on earth that's out of a lab. That's frankly an idiotic idea. What it tells you though is more about the fact that there is immunocompromised reservoirs of people out there, and we need to share our vaccine doses, not just ethically, but also puts the brake on virus evolution.
Yeah.
And the fact that we're wasting our Novavax doses, our AZ doses, is a crying shame. So the whole Western world is guilty of doing that.
What's next? What's worrying you about what you're seeing?
Viruses spill over from animals to humans all the time, right? It's a continual process. I mean, people are exposed to wildlife diseases on a regular basis. They've estimated there are thousands of these spillovers going on each year. In particular, areas of hot biodiversity like Southeast Asia, for example. I think there are 3 groups of viruses that I'm most worried about, right? And their common factor is they're all respiratory. And respiratory viruses are the one. I mean, like things, for example, Ebola, which is a horrendous thing, causes terrible, terrible suffering. That's not going to cause a global pandemic, anything like that, because it's direct body fluids that pass it on. And we can always kind of control that, right? Dengue yellow fever, these vector-borne viruses, horrendous though they are, they're not going to cause a global pandemic because we can always, in the West, control mosquito ranges pretty well. The ones that worry me are respiratory ones, right? Because they're the ones that are hardest to control. And your worst-case scenario, and unfortunately SARS-CoV-2 is an example of this worst-case scenario, is your silent spreader, your asymptomatic transmission. That is incredibly hard to control, right? Three groups of viruses that worry me most then are coronaviruses, right?
Yep.
Which animals have an awful lot, and we're discovering new ones, you know, almost every day. Coronaviruses, influenza viruses may sound mm-hmm. kind of boring, but again, huge diversity in wildlife, particularly birds. They're being brought into Australia all the time in birds. Respiratory, and can be devastating. And the other one is a paramyxoviruses. So things like in Australia, we have Hendra, luckily very rare in humans, gets into horses and we think comes from bats. In Asia, there's Nipah, that's a relative of Hendra. But there mm-hmm. are other of these paramyxoviruses we know, again, very commonly in wildlife. So they're the three that most worry me, okay? I think, and of those three, it's hard to say. I'm always concerned about a nasty flu, because flu can a novel flu strain could be absolutely devastating. Although right. coronavirus has been, I mean, it's been horrendous. It's the worst since 1918, easily the worst since 1918.
Are we doing enough to stop transmission?
Nope. Overall, this country's response has been good. And successive regimes, I think they've listened to the science. And overall, there's been some failures, obviously. I won't go into those. But overall, it's been pretty good, right? I think, though, that the major lessons that we've learned from this pandemic is the threat posed by wildlife and our interaction with wildlife and how we respond to that. I don't see evidence of systems being put in place that are going to stop that happening. What we need, yeah. we absolutely need, is some sort of global pandemic radar, was the phrase that was used in often for this. So somewhere where we're monitoring people who live and work at the human-animal interface. They work at live animal markets or in the wildlife trade or in abattoirs or live near bat roosts or animal carers or vets, all those sorts of people. They are on the front line. They're being exposed. We need some way globally, not just China, not just Asia, right? Globally. Mm-hmm. We survey those people. And the science, we have the techniques of surveillance are there. We have all the genomic and serology we can do for that. They're surveyed on a regular basis, like the canaries in the coal mine. And then we take that data and we share it globally, rapidly. And as soon as something untoward happens, we lock down, quarantine in that area. That's what we need. Now, scientifically, that's quite easy. I don't think that's a challenge at all. Economically, cost billions, but it's probably less than we've lost on the submarine deal, you know, in Australia. Frankly,
yes,
frankly, sure it is. You know? So scientifically, I think it's fine. I think economically, I don't see a problem. The problem is it's politics now. It's absolutely politics. And unfortunately, now it's so toxic that China and the US are just pointing finger at each other. The chances of the Chinese now, the chances of a country like that sharing their data openly, freely, without IP, you know, intellectual property, I think that's, it's been reduced. I think actually in many ways we're in a worse position than we were before the pandemic started. The number one thing we need is global cooperation. That's how we fight a pandemic, right? If there was an outbreak of a disease in Russia, would Vladimir Putin tell people about it? I very much doubt it.
Yeah.
So sadly, that has tarnished the advances in science. And until we can fix the politics, I don't think we'll fix pandemics. In the election campaign, I think that the consensus amongst all the parties was the pandemic is over. It's not worth talking about. Let's not discuss it. The pandemic's not over, right?
No.
It will keep going and we'll keep getting new variants. And you know, there's no votes in it, obviously, discussing this, but that's the reality of the situation.
Yeah.
I think people should take, if they want to wear a mask, they wear a mask. So no wonder we're getting these new, you know, these things spreading around. So if case numbers start to ratchet up quite dramatically, we'll see what happens. But you're right, at the moment, it's a non-issue really politically at the moment.
Eddie, thank you for being the voice of sanity.
I try and call it as it is, you know.
Thank you for taking the time to have a chat.
My pleasure. It was great talking to you.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.